Howdy, welcome to Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along for this August Thursday or Friday, depends on when you're listening. Today, college students from UW-Stout in seven states, along with faculty mentors, conducted some research this summer surrounding the visual fact that some lakes in the Menominee area turn green from bacteria. We're going to talk with one of the directors of the project to get an overview of how it's meant to impact those involved. And basically, that's everyone who looks at, uses, and lives near or on the lake or on waterways that feed them. Singer Ellen White is here on her annual pilgrimage from Oregon to take the stage with instrumental sensation Sue Orfield on various evenings and venues through the end of the month. Both ladies are here. Jim Oliver makes his weekly tandem appearance with news about what's on stage in western Wisconsin, and he'll share a conversation detailing another Shakespeare sighting in Amory. Seems to happen around this time of year. Here's where we begin this week's audio buffet.
All the best things in life are free, but you can give it to the birds and bees. Give me some money.
Here's a bound to be enjoyable evening just down the road, the 5th annual Chippewa Valley Museum Heritage Celebration. And for the second year running, it's all about the iconic dance hall Ferniers from Eau Claire's days gone by. That's the music of the Thundermen, a 1960s and beyond Eau Claire guys band, who are providing the dance music for this year's celebration in September. John Vanek from the museum and Mickey Linus, drummer for the Thundermen, are here. And Mickey, I heard Ferniers had a couple levels. Is that right?
I truly was never all the way up there. Halfway up the stairs was like a dressing room for the bands. The second floor was a bar. Private bar, I thought. I don't believe there was a dance hall up there. And people would come from, like I said, everywhere. There was always Lou, the lady that owned the place, selling tickets at the front door. There was a cop, always had the cop. The dance floor, we found out later. I just talked to a lady this week that said the dance floor would move up and down.
Oh, I'm sure.
Strangely enough, when they tore the place down in 72, my grandmother, my dad, and his younger brother were over there as the guy was tearing it down, and the floor actually had springs underneath it.
Ah.
And my uncle had all of the ceiling tiles and the change, homemade wooden change drawer. I don't know where that went to now.
You said it had ceiling tiles. You know, we've all been in one of the old ballroom casino-type places. I mean, and they were all over Wisconsin years ago.
Years ago, yeah.
Did it have a roof like that, or did it have just a straight roof, or was it a high ceiling? What was it?
It was kind of it was only a single story. It was higher, higher ceiling, and it was kind of canted in.
Okay.
The stage, it was two levels, and me being the drummer, I was up on the second level.
Oh.
If you stood up, the ceiling was canted back towards you. The lighting was nothing more than two old living room pole lamps.
Really?
That's all there was, besides whatever lighting was in the place. And the men's bathroom was right, if they had the windows open, you were standing right there looking out and could talk to people on the sidewalk as they were walking by.
And that was down, by the river?
It's right where by the courthouse. There's on Ann Street, corner of Ann and First Avenue. Since they've remodeled the courthouse, it's kind of hard to pick out where it was now. But there's a historical marker down there.
Oh, there is.
A local real estate agent, Dave Mickelson, lived right across the street, and he said his parents actually met at Ferniers. Somebody came up with the idea, well, there are historical markers all over Eau Claire, and he got the idea to have one put up. So he took it upon himself to research it. And
do you have any photographs from when your band played there?
I have a few, few, that someone took of one of the bands.
Yeah, because I've seen the exterior. I've never seen the interior. I've never seen a photograph of it. So the acoustics were good in there, but back then, who cared?
Back then, who knows?
That's right. That's
you know, we had a 35-watt Harman Kardon outdoor-type PA system, and homemade speak went to Bushland.
You didn't even mic drums those days.
No. I really wonder how it sounded live. I truly do, because there was no microphone. A microphone for the singers, and the guitar amps were not anywhere near this powerful.
And they weren't mic'd.
They just
went straight up.
I've often wondered what bands really sounded like.
So, John, how did this discussion all get underway?
Staff at the museum were trying to brainstorm in 2014 for a fundraiser event This, in 2015, is the fifth annual Heritage in the Valley fundraiser for the Chippewa Valley Museum.
And other themes have been?
And other themes. The first 3 years were sort of ethnic heritage. There was an Irish heritage and a German heritage. We got pretty good crowds, but everybody was sort of the opinion that if I'm not German, I'm not going to go to Oompa-Palooza. So we hit on this, and it's a much more recent. There are people still living who can very directly connect to Fernier's Ballroom. The outpouring that we got as soon as it was announced from people who remembered it and and thought it would be just a fantastic idea to have a night where we recreate Fernier's as much as we really could, just with people who shared those memories and food sort of reminiscent of the 60s.
I got
or
a kick
the
out
50s.
Of that menu. Yeah, that's cool. Just so that we can whet people's appetites, tell us what's on that, because I think anybody who lived through that era will say, oh, you nailed that.
Yeah, so it's a classic 60s supper club meal, and this year's menu features beef stroganoff set on egg noodles with a Waldorf salad, honey glazed baby carrots, breadsticks, and a pineapple upside down cake for dessert.
The Waldorf salad's what got me. And the only other thing you could do that could make it real authentic, Jell-O with vegetables in it.
Bringing in a local band like the Thundermen to play and just to recreate that atmosphere for one night just for fun.
And it will be.
This is the second year that we've done it. We did it last year, and the response was so great, we decided to do it again. Lined up and timed it in accordance with a couple class reunions. So we're trying to reach people who maybe didn't hear about it in time last year or who only heard about it after the fact, because everyone who went had a blast.
Does the museum have Fernier's material in it?
We have some. A past employee did a lot of research on Fernier's when she was a student, and she's going to come back and give another talk about the history of Fernier's. We have a few photographs, but for the most part, we relied last year, and we're going to rely again on people in the community willing to share objects or artifacts or materials or memories. We'll take all of it and share it all on that evening.
We're in the studio with John Vanek, editor at the Chippewa Valley Museum, and Mickey Linus. He is the drummer for the Thundermen. Now, is the lineup for September 10th going to be the original Thundermen, or how's it going to work?
As many as we can. I'm the only original member that still performs regularly with the band. Okay. Our original lead singer will be there, Al Fremstead. He quit the band some years ago, but he still comes quite regularly and gets up and does a few songs. And Dave Ingedahl was not an original member of the band, but he was in the 90s. He's coming back. And then the two members that we have now, John Trigstead and Calvin Lester, have been with the band for about 15 or 20 years.
A good addition to having a 60s dance with the likes of the Thundermen would be to have a couple of go-go cages on each side of the stage with some girls in them with big white boots. And
we'll see if we can find some volunteers who may have done that in their youth.
The difference between bands now and bands back then bands were more than happy to be cover bands because it's basically all you ever played. I mean, you were expected to play the hits and that's what you did.
That's right. That was the thing back then. It was, well, they sounded just like so-and-so.
Yeah.
And that was apparently important to the people. The Thundermen have never tried to be that, to do that.
You never specialized in sounding like one group more than anything?
Do
you feel like, personally, you did one group really well?
Well, many people, even I remember taking my son to school one day. He was only five, and Rock Around the Clock was on the radio.
Ah.
And he said, "Dad, is that Al? Our lead singer sounds a lot like Bill Haley."
So is this the big fundraiser for the museum, or is this it just one of them?
This is one of them. This is one of the two big ones. Our 4th of July fun fair, that's a big community day, is also a fundraiser. The ticket and the silent auction proceeds and everything goes towards the Chippewa Valley Museum and figuring out how we can have even more fun next year.
So, John, how do we get tickets for this?
Call the Chippewa Valley Museum at 715-834-7871. Individual tickets for dinner and the dance are $50. Price includes both dinner and music. $15 of that is tax deductible. Or, if you just want to come for the dance portion, show up at Florian Gardens at 8 o'clock, and those tickets are $25.
John Vanek, Mickey Linus, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The date is Thursday, September 10th at Florian Gardens in Eau Claire. As you said, again, the phone number for tickets to Ferniers for a Night is 834-7871. Email is info@cvmuseum.com. Music by the Thundermen, kind of like this in the background here. Oh, yeah, try not to dance. Coming up, Shakespeare's Funny Side, performed in Amory, Wisconsin. A couple of grand dames of music making the rounds, singing and playing up a storm. And next, green is good for a lot of things, but not the color of lakes. Support for WPR comes from Simply Dunn in Downsville, home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery influenced by nature, including tableware, vases, and cookingware. More at simply-dunn.com. Support also comes from Luther College, where students can partner with faculty on challenging research that often results in publishing papers together and presenting at conferences. Visit information at luther.edu. I noticed a story about a summer study recently concluded concerning the fact that the color of some lakes in our neighborhood has a reputation for changing to verdant, something lakes aren't supposed to do. Menominee and Tainter Lakes, in and near Menominee, were the targets, and many of the researchers were students. The acronym for the project is LAKES, R-E-U, standing for Linking Applied Knowledge and Environmental Stability Research Experience for Undergraduates. Wow. Dr. Nels Paulsen is an associate professor of sociology at Stout. We invited him to the studio for an overview, and I'm glad we did. Simply put, it's the fact that students from seven states spent 8 weeks at Stout studying lakes that turn green. If you can, without making it a verbal doctoral dissertation, expound on that for us. Tell us what it is you did and what generated this and how long it's been in the works.
Sure. Well, the basic idea is that we have the cyanobacteria. It's not an algae. It's a bacteria that's formed in a lot of lakes, not just in Wisconsin, but around the world. It's particularly bad in Lake Menominee and Lake Tainter, and it comes from mostly phosphorus, or entirely phosphorus pollution that's largely runoff coming off of people's land. The question that I had when I first arrived as a sociologist is, how do people change their land use so that we don't have the runoff? I realized I didn't know enough about the ecology of it, the geology and the biology, but I also didn't know enough about the economics of how to change things or the idea of changing culture, which is a lot of what we're talking about here. Okay. And so the idea that I had, along with a few others, was to create an interdisciplinary project involving a lot of different disciplines to ask economics questions, anthropological questions, geological questions, sociological questions. And so that's what formed this LAKES project. And so we ended up getting a National Science Foundation grant to do this research experience for undergraduates focused on phosphorus pollution. And we basically are trying to understand, how do you change culture through incentives that are very constrained by, you know, our political system and our economic system, especially, you know, agriculture, and, you know, what kind of impact is that going to have, not just ecologically, but financially on a local economy. And so we're asking a lot of those types of questions.
See, that makes it even more interesting to me, because I didn't realize this was a sociological bit of research.
Yeah, so I'm trained as a sociologist. Well,
and I'm happy it's not scientific, because then you won't lose me along the way.
Yeah, so my component, it focuses on the farmers themselves. And so what gets them to take on certain management practices, conservation tillage, cover crops, manure storage, and so on and so forth, that would reduce the runoff, because that's most of the land in the Red Sierra watershed, and thus a lot of the contributions. And so what I focus on is their social networks. Who do they talk to about their farming practices? Who do they trust? And what I've discovered is that really those who are more integrated into a network of farmers within the watershed are more likely to take on these best management practices.
Okay.
And the more that they see government agencies and government policies as fair, the more likely they're to take on these best management practices. And what this suggests is to form these farmer-led
initiatives where farmers take the lead on how do they change farming practices in their watershed, their sub-watershed, while working with NRCS and UW Extension and land conservation divisions and so on and so forth. And so that's the component I was most interested in, and these are some of the findings that we're getting, is that, that that's a real possibility, but, you know, that's a big challenge. We also had an economics component this last summer that focused on economic impact, on, you know, what would a clean watershed look like, financially for the community. Conservatively, the figures are around $36 million a year just for Menominee, which is pretty tremendous, and it's pretty thorough economic impact analysis. And then we had this anthropological component that was just, how do we get policies and policymakers to be doing the type of stuff that is going to lead to land use change? Mm-hmm. What are the constraints that they feel? And a lot of the workers that are working for government agencies, they're constrained by having to do so many different things that they aren't able to work face-to-face with landowners enough, which is really where you see the biggest changes, right? Mm-hmm. And so this suggests that there's some fiscal constraints in terms of how we're funding some of these agencies. And then, of course, we found out this summer that there's this big question a lot of people had: how much natural phosphorus is there in the land? Is this really a runoff problem? We actually had a geologist, Dr. Matt Kukta, as part of our project this summer, take a look at that. And lo and behold, he discovered that there is some natural phosphorus.
I read that about new rocks and old rocks.
Yeah, we know where these are, and we know that it's mostly still a runoff problem, but we do have a really solid answer for people in terms of where the natural phosphorus is. Mm-hmm. On the east side of the watershed, for example, there's far more phosphorus that's natural in terms of this layer of sediment that didn't get wiped out by the glaciers. I'm probably not understanding completely because I'm not the geologist on the project, but and it has these brachiopods, these shells that have a lot of phosphorus that are in that layer. That's more on the east side than on the west side. But that said, we know a little bit more about how much contribution that's coming from natural. And so we're basically trying to feed all of this information into people who are working on this problem. Government agencies are working together to form this TMDL plan, Total Maximum Daily Load. Environmental Protection Agency at a federal level says, okay, you have an impaired water, let's see your plan for moving forward, and therefore, if we say that your plan looks good, you can be eligible for certain funds in order to go about your plan for actually fixing the problem. Mm-hmm. And so there's this group that's been meeting this last year, and the Lakes Project has been a part of it in terms of feeding our research into it, projecting that with following the recommendations from our research and others, we could possibly reduce the phosphorus by as much as 41% over the next 10 years, which, you know, would basically mean almost an extra month of summer. You know, not enough to completely fix the problem, because 10 years is a short amount of time for changing land use. But, you know, it's a bit ambitious, but it is possible. And so that's where we're hoping a lot of our work is going to be very applied.
So very simplified, your study basically comes up with reasons why it's a good idea to fix this.
Yeah, that's a good way to simplify it, yeah.
You have to figure out how to bring people together and make people come to the realization that they may be part of the problem.
You know, I have, in terms of what academic research should mean, is it should be a starting point for conversation, for people in the community to be more connected to the solutions themselves. And so that's why at the end of our 8-week study with the students, we have them produce these research posters and present them at the Raw Deal, which is this large coffee shop in Menominee. And we invite people to have conversations with the students about what the research is. But the cool thing that came out of this the last couple summers is we had several hundred people come in, but then they end up talking to each other. And so what the research gives is a better starting point for the conversations.
People saying, well, let's work together on this.
Yeah, and so that's the hope for what this research is. This is our little contribution to trying to address this problem, is that we can start the right types of conversations for others to, you know, contribute.
That's a great idea. Are you going to make this information available now going forward to people who say, I own a farm, I want to see this?
Absolutely, yeah. So we are going to do it in a few different ways. We're going to have all of the students write op-eds for the Dunn County News over the next month, and we'll have descriptions of their initial findings that were reported at the Raw Deal a couple weeks ago. We'll also have all of that information up on our website, which is www.uwstout.edu/lakes. And that'll be up in early fall. We expect to write a white paper, a collective white paper, not for academic audience, but a general audience. Uh-huh. And then, of course, we hope to present this at academic conferences and publish it in peer-reviewed journals. There's a very transformative thing when students are doing applied research. They start to see themselves as more than just students, but as people who can do something that's helpful for the community. Mm-hmm. To have really bright, ambitious students to make that extra step so that when whether they come back to Wisconsin or they go back to their own communities or whatever career path they take, mm-hmm. they'll be able to, I think, see themselves in a new way, take on this new identity of being more than just learners, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so they ended up creating this community among themselves, bunch of different backgrounds, bunch of different places where they really wanted to help one another. I think that came from being connected to the community initially. So a lot of community members in the first couple weeks, they created these little gatherings for meeting the REU students. And I think a lot of students were excited about that. So I think this speaks to a desire in Menominee to really transform the culture and make it a community effort at solving this pollution problem.
We're in the studio with Nels Paulsen, Ph.D. from UW-Stout. He was the director of a summer program called LAKES REU. It's an acronym for Linking Applied Knowledge in Environmental Stability Research Experience for Undergraduates. This wasn't a study of why the lakes turn green, just the fact that they do and what we're going to do about it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So, and I would think that this was a wonderful opportunity for you as an educator because as a sociologist, you then got to rub elbows with guys and gals in all other disciplines. You got to work with biologists and geologists.
Absolutely.
And that makes for good camaraderie.
It does. It makes for good camaraderie. It makes for a little bit better understanding of what our disciplines do and what they can contribute to some of the solutions. As a matter of fact, so the anthropologist and the economist on the project, the economist is named Chris Ferguson. He's actually the co-director of the Lakes Project. He and I both started at Stout at the same time and are in the social science department together. So he has an economics PhD, I have a sociology PhD. You know, a lot of times these are pitted at odds with one another in social sciences as trying to address different things. And what we found early on is that when we sit down and have a beer together at the end of the day, there are a lot of ways that he can address questions with the type mm-hmm. of research he does that are different from mine but are really valuable at getting a different angle. And so I think we realized early on that we wanted to work together and learn from one another. And then Dr. Tina Lee, she's an anthropologist who came a couple years after us but in the same department. We basically got the same feeling from her that she asked different questions that were getting at angles that we hadn't thought of. Mm-hmm. And so we've actually been working together for quite a few years, and it made a lot of sense for us to go together on this Lakes project because we really embrace this idea of learning from one another disciplinarily.
And when you discover that there are avenues that you didn't plan on traveling, that's exciting stuff.
It is, yeah. And it's more useful to the general community in terms of we're asking better questions. Mm-hmm. We're giving, I think, better starting points for their conversations, trying to really embrace some different ways of thinking.
What's the definition of sociology? Is it making the world a better place?
Well, the hope is that that's a moral imperative for any discipline. Sociology is essentially just the systematic study of society.
The good parts and the bad parts.
The good parts and the bad parts. Okay. It asks, okay, where do our social problems come from?
Okay.
Right? And where do our wonderful outcomes in society, our mm-hmm. happiness, where does this stuff come from? How do we create norms and values in society that end up constraining us in some ways or supporting certain outcomes that we desire? Mm-hmm. And so these are the types of questions that sociology tries to address.
You know, and I was gonna ask this question from a scientific angle, but now that you're a sociologist, it makes even better sense. In science, is it and you're not a scientist, but sociology is a science.
It's sociology a social science. Is a science, yep.
Sure. Yep. Is it a prerequisite for a scientist or a researcher to possess a societal or shared concern for something in order to push him or her to take research to a conclusion? Does there have to be emotion involved, or is mm-hmm. it enough just to be curious about reasons, outcomes, and resolutions?
That's a great question. There's this long tradition of thinking that science is this objective, neutral thing.
You don't need to care about what you're doing. Just do it.
Yeah, right? It doesn't involve emotion. And what we've actually discovered is that when people lose the ability to attach emotion to their decision-making, they actually become completely paralyzed. They can't make a decision. Emotion is central to anything that we do. What we ask as social scientists is that we evaluate the values that inform the questions that we ask.
Oh, sure.
There is no such thing as complete objectivity. And so we have to ask ourselves, if we're going to prioritize studying farmers and, you know, their best management practices, what is the moral imperative for that? And usually it lends itself to a question of justice, right? What is fair? What is just? And often these kinds of questions about justice are best arrived at through understanding how do people get along. And so there is this moral imperative for anybody to really be thinking about the community. How do people get along as the moral obligation of our research? Mm-hmm. And that has a very strong emotional tie. It's largely what makes us human. We're ultra social, you know, beings. And so as a consequence, you know, that social component of prioritizing that connection to other people, I think is something that we should all reflect on. What does that mean? What should it mean for our research?
Well, here's an explosive can of worms for you. Social media. I mean, you as a sociologist your head must be spinning.
Because... Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's really a cool thing that people are able to be more connected to one another through social media. Think of Facebook. How many high school and college friends that I would have completely lost touch with that I now know what's going on in their lives and what they value and so on and so forth. What we've seen is that this is qualitatively different than face-to-face interactions. Even though it seems like it's more connected, and it is more connected, it's not necessarily the meaningful connections.
Quantitatively,
you know, it's much more connected, but, you know, the quality of those interactions is quite a bit different.
A discussion of what we're talking about could go on for – this is like talking religion.
It should go on further. It should always be improving the conversation. There's this economist sociologist from early 19th century Wisconsinite, Thorsten Veblen, who said that the best outcome to come from research is when you start with one research question and end up with three that are better than that first question.
Oh, cool.
Right. Yeah. And so the idea is that we're always asking better questions and having better discussions at the very least.
You know, and when we think society – most of the time, the immediate thought is society is this great big thing, but most of us have smaller societies within that big society, and it's the smaller societies that we can help control.
Yeah, and you know, when we dwindle it down to scale, we can definitely make a difference in this space at this time, and you know, it's empowering.
Well, this is a tangent I didn't expect to get off on, and we're going to... we're going to follow it. Thanks for being with us on Spectrum West and for the research. And when the lakes in Menominee become clear again, we'll have you to thank.
Oh, well, I'll be doing my little part. There's a lot of people involved.
So what started as a discussion about the sociology of dealing with the health of lakes bloomed into an idea for a future program, one we're going to pursue. Conversation with participants in and observers of social media, what it means to society overall. Thanks to Dr. Nels Paulson of UW-Stout. Congratulations to all who participated in this summer's lake study, and good luck keeping that important ball rolling. Jim Oliver reports on A Midsummer Night's Dream. Ellen White and Sue Orfield are quite a team. That's next. And here's a pertinent question to ask during a program about the arts and culture of Wisconsin. What's on stage? The answer is multifaceted. The man with the plan is Jim Oliver.
Thanks, Al. The Red Velvet Cake will run through August 29th at the Red Barn Theater in Rice Lake. The Barron Spotlighters will perform the musical Annie Get Your Gun through Saturday at the Barron Area Community Center. The Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake will stage the musical Fiddler on the Roof through Sunday. Junior Player Summer Camp will conclude Friday at the Wide Spot Performing Arts Center in Stockholm with the production of In Search of the Blue Medallion, an original script by Michelle Meyer. Admission is free, with a free will offering at the door. A Streetcar Named Desire will be staged tonight, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The show will continue in repertory until September 6th. The So Good Improv Company will perform Friday at the festival. Auditions for the musical Into the Woods will be held Wednesday and Thursday from 6:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The director is Beth Reidenbach. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will hold auditions at 5:30 p.m. Sunday and Monday for its fall touring show, Skippy John Jones. The Children's Theater has also scheduled auditions for Little Shop of Horrors for 7 p.m. Monday and Tuesday. And that's some of what area theater companies are doing. I'm Jim Oliver for Spectrum West.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm Al Ross. This is Spectrum West. Thank you for being here. Each year, vocalist Ellen White, a resident of the music-savvy town of Portland, Oregon, travels to Wisconsin to visit and perform with her good pal Sue Orfield, one of our most gifted instrumentalists. They've performed at several events already, including Tuesday Night Blues this past Tuesday, taken indoors due to rain. I was fortunate to be there. And the White Orfield Band, which includes other accomplished musicians, has some dates left before Ms. White heads west again. They stop by for a chat. So here we are, you guys, old buddies.
9 years and running.
I don't know that I've ever, and maybe if I did, I don't care. I want you to repeat it. How did you guys meet?
Wow. We met at a blues festival that was up in Republic, Washington, which is the northeast corner of Washington State, close to the Canadian border. And we both played with separate bands at this festival, and there was a jam session afterward. And we got up on stage together. And it was instant chemistry, both personal and musical. Then we sort of really got to know each other after that at a gig called The Tribe of Five with a band that was mostly an all-female band. Mm-hmm. And we did a stint in Alaska, which neither one of us will ever forget. It was amazing. Because it was just hysterical. I was coming off a really bad illness. I had pleurisy, believe it or not. And so I was a little bit sick during this time, but it didn't make any difference at all. We, Ellen and I, were roommates.
Right.
And during, remember this? It was
we
a five-day stint. And
yep.
We just laughed from Monday to Friday or whatever the dates were. We just laughed. It was so great. And musically, it was also really an amazing experience. And that's really when we started bringing Ellen up to Seattle, or I would go down her way to Portland to play with the band and all that.
Was her recount right?
She's absolutely right, Your
yeah.
Honor. I rest my case.
But you agree with all of the niceties she said.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And not to mention that we had one hysterical drummer on that Alaskan tour with us. His name was Pete Langens. He was also known as Pete the Beat. And every night after the gig, he would just come in and hold court with his comedic routine, and we would be rolling on the floor laughing. It just kept us up at all hours of the night, entertaining us for really all through the night.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It was a fun experience.
That's
perfect. When we got to know each other, and you know, this long friendship, musical and personal, was born at that point.
Had you been to Wisconsin before?
Oh, no. No, this is my, this is my new home away from home.
Mm-hmm.
My go-to, have a good
time. So now everybody thinks.
Eat cheese place.
There you are. Good place to come and get constipated. So now everybody knows everything about how hip Portland is as a music town. What do people out west and northwest think of Wisconsin as a music place?
Oh, I have to really educate the people back home because they think it's cheese and, who is it, the Packers?
The Packers
right.
And they're
and
right
so
about that.
They
the
are
way.
Right about that.
But
you
there's
know,
more
that,
to it, believe it or not.
That is sort of your trademark here in this area.
Sure.
But, you know, I've been extolling the virtues of this area for a long time. I said it's the best kept secret in the U.S. You know, this area has a really growing and thriving music scene across the board, all genres of music, some really great singer-songwriters out here, and, you know, the people are here to support it, which is really great.
Yep.
The day on which we're speaking is Tuesday, and you're scheduled to do the blues in Owen Park, and you still have some other gigs set up before you head west again. Tell us about some of those.
Friday, the 21st of August, we are going to be at the Old Schaefer Creamery Event Center in Schaefer, Minnesota. And Ellen and I will be doing a meet and greet at 7 o'clock with whoever wants to come and meet and greet with us. And then the show starts at 8. On Saturday, August 22nd, we are going to be at the Munson Bridge Winery, which is a lovely place over in Withy, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. Mm-hmm. And on Sunday, August 23rd, we'll be going down to Stockholm, Wisconsin to play our home in Stockholm, which is Gelly's Pub and Eatery. Yeah. And it's a lovely gig we do every year. And then after that, our next gig will be, I'm really excited about this one. It's such a cool setting. This is going to be the Sue Orfield Show. We're in the almost the end of season two.
Where I live, I don't get it, so I've never been able to watch.
You can actually watch the shows that have been released on the Chippewa Valley Community Television's website. The concept behind the show is that we do this live show.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a concert, and they film the concert, and with very good people behind the cameras, they edit it, and it's mixed really well, so it's a really neat thing. But the live show is going to be at the Eau Claire Children's Theater on Thursday, August 27th.
Yeah.
They have been spectacularly fun. Every single one of these shows has been so much fun. It's been diverse. And with Ellen, it is going to be a total blast. We're going to have the horn section and the whole nine yards. I mean, I'm really excited about this one. And then the last gig is the Park Theater on August 28th up in Hayward, Wisconsin.
Wow. Sue Orfield and Ellen White in the studio with us on Spectrum West. People who know you think that it's all about music. Every waking moment is music to you guys. What else do you like to do? What's relaxing for you?
Writing a grant?
No,
take that back.
Oh, my.
I just finished writing a huge grant for a project that I hope to launch back home. And it's for an alternative high school. And I've been doing these artist in residencies for the last 5 years. Ah. And this particular project that I want to will be writing a musical play for the first time in my life. Doing everything from the ground up. The theme of this project will be the genocide in Rwanda. I was just in Rwanda in June, and I had an opportunity to visit the area. I wrote a song with kids in a chemistry class about the properties of water. Yeah, it's pretty wild, let me tell you. Soon to follow, there will be a link to that at some point. So I visited two of the memorials. The first one is in Kigali, which is the capital of Rwanda, where 100,000 people are buried in a mass grave. The second one is out in Bugesera, which is called the Nyamata Genocide Memorial. And there was a woman buried at the church who was the hero in this ordeal. Her name is Antonia Locatelli. And Antonia's life is going to be memorialized through this play.
The music of this play is going to be rather poignant, I would guess.
Very poignant. And the students are going to develop the script and research, not in textbooks, but in a variety of primary resources. It's really going to be an exciting and very creative learning experience for them, a whole different way to look at a subject matter. And Antonia's story has never really been told, and there's very little about her online, so we're going to have to do some big digging to find out more about her.
So that's not relaxing, but that's...
No, that's I think she was kidding about the grant writing. Yeah. It's been it's been pretty intense.
It has been.
But it's kind of it must be kind of a hobby for you, because you're doing it because you want to.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely love working with students. I mean, for me, that's a whole lot of fun. But on relaxing that note, it has to be...
We take walks.
Walks.
I love
to walk.
Now, that leads into one of my other questions. Is there always a music-related aspect to other things you do? You notice something and it becomes a melody or a song title. Does music play in your head at night? You may walk to relax. And then that gets to my last question is, how do you keep music your friend rather than your dictator?
He knows way too much.
I know.
Excellent. I'll take the first bit of that.
Because you're both very busy. That's the point.
It is. And it's true. Your question was, does music always come into whatever we're doing? And the answer to that would be no. But often it does.
Yeah.
So
it creeps in.
It often does. But there are times when I want to watch Law and Order on TV or something. And I don't want to think about the music, because in fact, those are times when stuff is ruminating and when we all need other things in our life so that the art makes sense.
I know that, but
exactly.
Are you successful at that?
It's a super good question. And yes, I am sometimes successful. And other times, like we took a walk this morning, and this beautiful little walk that we took, there's all these birds singing and talking to each other. And it's music of a sort, but it's not anything that's organized.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just listening and enjoying it. So audio information, but not musical in the same sense.
Okay.
And it was lovely. Anyway, yeah, sometimes you can become a slave to that thing where an idea comes and you can't get away from it. And the truth is that sometimes welcome and sometimes unwelcome.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always one way or the other for me.
So. Do you have new stuff for me to listen to or not?
Oh, that's right. We have a holiday record.
Well, there you go.
There you go. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Christmas in August.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Angels, we have heard.
How about you? Are you recording stuff?
Look, I have a new one that I did. It doesn't have to do with any of my bands, but is actually now the theme song for the Sue Orfield show that I recorded. It's called The Unwitting Man About Town.
And being a TV theme, it'll be ingrained in our heads and we'll be whistling it all.
Yes, it's a pretty singable little melody. There's...
If it gets that famous, then you're really in.
You made bank.
Yes.
Thanks for stepping in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Al.
It's lovely to see you again.
The Christmas album features Ellen White and friends called Season of Peace, and Sue Orfield has multiple albums with several groups available. And the Sue Orfield show can be accessed online at cvctv.org for tickets for next Thursday's show and video on demand of past programs as well. Ah, yes. The joy of doing a program like Spectrum West. Did you know support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona? The MMAM presents 10 exhibitions per year and has masterpieces by Turner, Constable, O'Keefe, and many more. Visit and support at MMAM.org. Well, it turns out even Shakespeare likes the North Woods, and Amory, Wisconsin is a place that he shows up every summer. Correspondent Jim Oliver now looks into that.
A Midsummer Night's Dream is a comedy play by William Shakespeare. It's believed to have been written between 1590 and 1597. The play is considered one of Shakespeare's most popular works for the stage. The Northern Lakes Theater Guild will perform A Midsummer Night's Dream Saturday and Sunday at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory. Joining us to talk about the Shakespeare comedy is Lemoyne McLaughlin, Executive Director of the Northern Lakes Center and Director of the play. Welcome back to Spectrum West.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be with you.
Well, you've done a number of Shakespeare productions. What number is this?
This is number 8, and we have tried to alternate between tragedies and comedies on an annual basis. This year is our comic year.
Well, give us a little bit of an idea of what A Midsummer Night's Dream is all about.
Well, A Midsummer Night's Dream is Shakespeare's play that combines three levels of existence, if you will. There's the level of the gods and goddesses at the top, and then the royalty levels of the king and the queen in the center. And then this group rehearsing a play to perform for the king and queen that are referred to as rude mechanicals, or they're kind of country bumpkins, I guess is the best way to describe them. And the play brings those three elements together.
I know that there are a lot of characters who have quite a few lines in the play, but there are some principal actors. Could you tell us who those people are playing those characters?
I guess the one we have to single out at the beginning is Bottom. In English vocabulary, is equal to ass in our contemporary vulgarity, perhaps.
Jawbone of an ass is a very insignificant part of the Bible, so I wouldn't worry about it.
There we go. Bottom is played by Malachi Becker, who is a River Falls graduate. I don't think he majored in theater, but I think he minored in theater. He's from Amory. And what happens to Bottom during the play, two of the ethereal people, Oberon and Titania, kind of have an argument. And Oberon, who has as his underling Puck, Puck turns Bottom's head into that of a donkey or an ass. And meanwhile, Oberon has colored the eyes of Titania so that she's fallen asleep. When she wakens, she will fall in love with the very first thing she sees. And of course, that turns out to be Bottom with the head of an ass. Mm-hmm. We have a whole lot of fun with all of that. Titania is Shannon Schacht, who is one of our regular performers. And then we've got several other local players as well. But those are the two main ones. Plus, we've got a whole lot of young people who are playing the parts of fairies and peas blossom, cobweb, moth, and mustard seed. And we're having great fun.
He is Lemoyne McLaughlin, who is director of the Northern Lakes Theater Guild production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Well, more years ago than I like to think about, I played Nick Bottom the Weaver in a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. I remember the director saying I was the perfect ass. I remember the director spending some time early in the rehearsal schedule to teach us what many of the old English words meant. So how should audiences prepare themselves for going back to hearing the King James version of English?
Well, you're always going to run into that, and you can't cover the entire vocabulary. My feeling always with Shakespeare is just be open. Let yourself go and enjoy what's going on stage. And in this particular case, you certainly would.
Now, some directors will place the setting in a different era than 16th century England to make the play easier to understand. I remember the production of Othello I saw was set in the Old South, and I know that UW River Falls a few years ago did King Lear in modern dress. So do you try any of those kinds of techniques, or you just play it straight?
Actually, we don't too much. We've got a really good set of Renaissance costumes, and so we usually use those.
Mm-hmm.
And we only do one Shakespearean performance annually. So we've been using our regular costumes. Another part to it is that here with A Midsummer Night's Dream, you've got these country bumpkins, one of whom dresses up as a woman, and so you want to keep that costuming as hilarious as you can. And so we've left it pretty standard.
Mm-hmm. Beyond Midsummer Night's Dream, what's going on at the Northern Lakes Center this coming fall?
Actually, A Midsummer Night's Dream is our last performance for the summer, and then in the beginning of October, we're going to be beginning a regular season, which goes October through April, and we've got some performers from outside the area coming in. We've got some local performers. Our local chamber orchestra will be performing on a monthly basis. We've got some students performing. We've got some really good students who are developing. We've got one classical guitar student who's already made two CDs. And then we usually do a Christmas performance of some kind. We're not absolutely sure what we're going to do yet with that one. Monthly, we try to get something musical, something theatrical, and something relating to our local writers. And then, of course, we have visual art exhibits.
Well, you were appointed the first poet laureate of Amory in 2003, and you told me a while ago that you're the poet laureate for life, so that's a good deal, I guess. Anyway, you have published four collections of poetry, Scent of Lilac and Other Poems, Lyra, Secrets from the Wings, and A Song of Summer Rain and Other Poems. Have you got something ready for us?
As we're experiencing this interview right now, I hear pleasant, soft summer rain happening here. And I would like to share the title poem from my fourth collection, A Song of Summer Rain. Relative to contemporary poetry, by the way, on public television, I heard a couple people discussing that only 2% of Americans read poetry anymore.
Oh, that's sad.
However, I, to a large extent, fault the poets. I mean, they've forgotten that poetry is not only expression, which, of course, poetry always has been, but it's also communication.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes contemporary poets forget about the whole communication side of the written word. And what I've ended up doing is going back to traditional forms. The poem that I would like to read is a villanelle, which goes back 1,000 years and has a very tight rhyme scheme to it. This is my attempt at one. It's called A Song of Summer Rain. As darkness gathered at our windowpane, and one by one the pleas of day denied, we listened to a song of summer rain. We watched the dimming daylight slowly strain, and inch by inch beyond our vision slide, as darkness gathered at our windowpane. Night's closing curtain forced sight to abstain from further focus, and as shadows died, we listened to a song of summer rain. Then evening breezes whispered their refrain in haunting harmony, which softly sighed as darkness gathered at our window pane. And so, with dense clouds cloaking that domain where distant planets, moons, and stars reside, we listened to a song of summer rain. Years hence, this memory will still remain, how once, as tangled strings of life untied, and darkness gathered at our windowpane, we listened to a song of summer rain.
Ah, yes. He is Lemoyne McLaughlin, poet, founder and executive director of the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory, and the director of the Northern Lakes Theater Guild production of William Shakespeare's comedy, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Performances are Saturday and Sunday evenings at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory. For ticket information, call 715-268-6811 or use your favorite internet search engine to find the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts. Lemoyne, thanks so much for being with us and bringing a taste of Shakespeare to Western Wisconsin and, of course, your poetry.
It's always good to be with you.
Always good to have Jim Oliver along for the ride each week. Here's a Spectrum memo. Saturday, it's the WHYS 7th Annual Bluegrass Festival. Lake Altoona County Park, it's noon to 7 p.m. Proceeds support community radio. Next Saturday and Sunday, the 33rd Festival in the Pines in Carson Park in Eau Claire. Lots going on there. Wow. Thank you, Kat Jacoby, for Feline, the right words of promotion. Downtown Debbie Brown for organization, and the Dean for leading the charge. Next week on Spectrum West, the show goes to the dogs. Fascinating. Writers' groups are popular. A homegrown jazz legend returns to Menominee. And more. Always more. On Spectrum West, I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. See you next week.